Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. We're honored today to have as our guest Luann Landon. And the first book we're going to discuss is titled Dinner at Miss Lady's, subtitled Memories and Recipes from a Southern Childhood. It was published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. And first of all, welcome Luann to the show, and thank you for appearing today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be on your show.
Thank you. You and I met at the Sewanee Writers Conference, and when we met, I did not know that you were a writer at the time. We were sitting at a table with I believe it was your husband David, Romulus Lenny, Andrew Hudgens, Aaron McGraw, and the two of us were sitting at the end of the table, and I just casually asked you if you had written anything, and you told me that in fact you had. And then you were kind enough to send me a copy of Dinner at Miss Lady's, which I've thoroughly enjoyed. And so to start out, why don't we talk about Dinner at Miss Lady's, because the book had there's kind of a story behind the story of how the book came to be published. And if you would, why don't you tell us a little bit about what happened when this book came to publication?
Yes. Dinner at Miss Lady's, as published by Algonquin, is a book of stories and a kind of memoir of my childhood summers that I spent in a small town in Greensboro, in Georgia, Greensboro, 80 miles east of Atlanta. And it has recipes from my family and friends and from my grandmother's, my grandparents' cook, Henrietta. When the first version of the book was going to be published in France, my husband had a sabbatical year in 79-80, and we had an apartment in Paris, and I would sometimes serve Southern food to our French friends. It was a time in Paris, in France, when the French were just beginning to be interested in other cuisines, and my French friends seemed to love this Southern food, which the recipes in my book are, I would call them, if I had to classify them, I would call them either the old plantation cooking or descended from that cooking, quite different from what some people think of as Southern cooking, and quite close to French cooking in many ways. I think some of the original recipes were French and adapted to local Southern products. But my friends in Paris suggested that I write a cookbook, and I did. And I found a publisher in Paris, a wonderful house that did very high quality art books and cookbooks, beautiful illustration, beautiful printing, that sort of thing. And the book, as it was originally planned, only had recipes and just a brief half-page introduction to each section of recipes. It was all ready to be published, and I'm sure all of us remember Black Monday in 1987.
Sure.
Hermes, the publisher, had the proofs ready to send me, and then came Black Monday. And they had to cancel all their publishing products. I never even received the proofs. That was, as you can imagine, such a disappointment and a setback. And I let the book drop for a year or two, and then friends encouraged me and said, go on with it. And I did, and added the text, the memoir part of the book. And then after several rejections, Algonquin accepted the book, and my wonderful editor there, Kathy Porries, had a great deal to do with shaping the final version and advising me, and she's quite a lot younger than I am, but she's much wiser, and she's a fine editor, and told me what she thought should be cut and where I should add more text and that sort of thing. And so the book as it appears now, which by the way is a very lovely looking book. They did a beautiful job. The art department did a beautiful job. And so the book was published by Algonquin in 1999 and has been selling fairly well ever since.
That's a wonderful story, and it is a beautiful book. And sometimes readers and listeners don't understand sometimes how hard editors fight for their authors in terms of getting photographs put on covers, and sometimes the publisher might not want to go to the expense of something. And it really is wonderful if you have an editor that's going to go to bat for you to include some of the things I think that do make it such a beautiful book.
Yes, Kathy went to bat for me and insisted that they include the photographs, which are mostly old photographs, family photographs, and some of them are, I think, interesting pictures of the period of the old days.
Yes, and just so the listeners know, I always make sure that I do my research before I do an interview, and I have prepared a couple of the recipes in the book, and they turned out beautifully, and my wife and I enjoyed them very much. So I have, not only have I read the book, I've cooked a couple of the recipes to great success, so thank you for that as well. Duane, one of the things that we like to do is to have authors read an excerpt from their book. And you and I have talked, and we decided that this being the holiday season, that one of the particularly poignant narratives is A Green Silk Dress. And if you would, tell us a little bit about, set up for us a little bit, A Green Silk Dress, how that fits into the narrative of the book, and then if you'd be so kind, read us a selection that we've talked about from Dinner at Miss Lady's, from a silk dream green dress.
Yes. A Green Silk Dress is the next to last chapter in the book, and the chapter, as I come toward the end of the book, I write about after spending childhood and adolescent summers in Greensboro with my grandparents, Aunt Henrietta, I went away to college. I went to Radcliffe, which was what the women's division of Harvard used to be called, and it was quite a different world. I wanted so much to go, and I think that my grandparents they didn't say I couldn't go, and they were willing to try and help me, but they I think basically were afraid of my leaving home and going to Harvard, that dangerous place.
Sure.
So this is the story of a Christmas dinner in Greensboro, and how I brought my grandfather, whom everyone called Judge, everyone in the little town called Judge, how I brought my grandfather around to sending me back to the second semester of my freshman year after I had made an almost uncorrectable mistake.
Okay.
A green silk dress. At the end of my first semester at college, I spent Christmas in Greensboro with Judge and Miss Lady. After living in the Northeast, I was struck with the security, self-sufficiency, and indolence of the Greensboro world. I became aware of the sound of my family's voices. My Georgia relatives spoke slowly, softly, with a musical cadence that rose and fell rhythmically. They seemed to have native expression for everything that happened in their lives, everything they wanted to talk about. The language, the food, the interiors, the landscape of this world fit together. All seemed sensuous and sweet. But even though there was comfort in being at home, I was uneasy. When I left for college, judge had given me a check to cover my book expenses, but I had spent all of it on clothes. I had had every intention of buying the books I needed and wanted, but when a friend from school took me to Bonwit Cellar in downtown Boston, I was so entranced with this beautiful place and its elegant merchandise that I forgot all about the Pelican edition of Shakespeare. The store was filled with contemporary versions of Aunt Claire's clothes and the kinds of things Miss Lady had brought back from Europe. I bought a green silk dinner dress and several other exquisite, unnecessary items. Miss Lady was upset, and Judge was exasperated and angry. What I had done confirmed what he had known all along. I was encountering bad influences in the North. He let me know that there would be no more book money forthcoming. Now I was afraid that Judge and Miss Lady would convince my mother that I must not go back to college, and the house was filled with tension. I thought of the lovely clothes I had bought, and they no longer gave me pleasure. I realized that I would have to live without the books that were so important to me, books that would teach me how to live and how to write. I wanted to make a contribution to Christmas dinner as my Christmas gift to Judge and Miss Lady. I asked Miss Lady to let me help. She doubted that my cooking would ever measure up to her standards. Only Henrietta could do things right for Miss Lady. But finally she said that I could make the dessert with Henrietta's help. On Christmas Eve morning, I woke up happy and impatient to make a Tennessee jam cake. On my way to the kitchen, I stopped in to see Miss Lady, as I always did in the morning, when she was having breakfast in bed. Propped up on the pillows in her pink silk bed jacket, the tray balanced on her knees, gesturing delicately with a silver fork and scrambled eggs, her face soft and unassembled, Miss Lady seemed to say that if she could just get through breakfast, she would be equal to the coming day. I stood by the side of her bed, and she gave me her hand. "Did you sleep well, darling?" she asked. Her hands felt like little birds that had fallen out of their tree, still warm, still throbbing. I could feel the delicate bones beneath the skin that was soft and down. Henrietta's kitchen, a big, light-filled room, was warmed by the fire that roared in the wood stove. Every morning at dawn, she got the fire going. She knew how to control the temperature by starting with newspaper and kindling, adding logs, and maneuvering the embers with the poker. Some things were cooked on the wood stove, some on the electric, and only Henrietta understood the distinction between them. She had laid out the ingredients for my cake on the kitchen table, along with the pottery mixing bowls. Henrietta imparted to me not only her art, but her confidence. I discovered that if I used fresh ingredients, and if I performed each step of the recipe in good order, in good time, I would achieve a successful result. I always had the wonderful sense of things happening as they should happen, of steady effort leading to tangible results. Creaming the butter and sugar for the Tennessee jam cake, adding the preserves and the fragrant spices, folding in the egg whites lightly and firmly, while my hands performed this pleasurable work, my mind played in a kind of reverie. My past made sense. My present was full. My future would be happy. handiwork, two beautiful golden cakes. Were they rich but light too? Had I added just the right amount of cinnamon? I scooped a small piece from the center of one of the cakes. Delicious. I took another piece. Wonderful. I looked around and saw that Henrietta was working at the sink, her back turned to the pantry. Soon I had eaten a hole in the center of the cake. I fell further into torment with each bite I took. I had summoned self-discipline, self-control to make the cake. I had balanced myself on that plateau. Now I was sliding down the mountain of self-indulgence, unable to stop myself. There were holes now in the center of both cakes. Henrietta opened the pantry door. What are you doing in here, Miss Llewellyn? Look at those cakes. You've eaten holes in Miss Lady's jam cake. I'm sorry, I stammered. The Lord preserve us. What will Miss Lady say? I burst into tears. Henrietta put her arms around me. Now don't you worry, Miss Llewellyn. We'll just fill those holes with icing. Miss Lady will never know the difference. Henrietta and I iced the cake and filled the holes with icing. As a finishing touch, she dipped a knife in hot water and ran it over the surface, smoothing and polishing. The cake looked like perfection. At 1 o'clock on Christmas Day, we seated ourselves at the dinner table. Miss Lady and Judge expected the best as usual, and they were not disappointed. The Christmas turkey, brown and buttery, with a pecan dressing over which Henrietta had labored for 2 days, the hot yeast rolls, the sweet potatoes with bourbon, the creamed spinach and artichokes. On this day, as on every other day in Greensboro, the smells from the kitchen filled Miss Lady's house with a sense of expectancy, the premonition that always preceded midday dinner that something good was going to happen. But even the prospect of good food had not relieved the tension at the dinner table. Judge was not only angry, but perplexed. He did not understand a young woman who had wanted to be a writer all her life, a dubious profession, in his opinion, and then, given the chance to become one, had spent her book money on a silk dress. I was too confused to defend myself, as bewildered by my impulsiveness and irrationality as Judge was. Miss Lady, hypersensitive as always to Judge's mood, was on the verge of tears. Tell us a story, Judge, she said, blotting her eyes with her handkerchief. Judge looked more cheerful. Telling a story was the best thing he could do, but he was in a difficult position. He had to say something that would amuse Miss Lady and that would also enlighten me about the true and proven way to live. He leaned back in his chair and balanced his cigarette on the ashtray beside his plate. Last year, I made a special trip to Atlanta. I had decided to give Miss Lady a book. She is a lady who reads, has all sorts of things going on in her head I have no notion of. I thought she would appreciate a book if I could find the right one, to let her know I remembered her birthday. Well, I called up one of my poker friends and asked him the name of the bookstore in Atlanta he favored. Cooper's was his choice. So I took myself off to Cooper's. No sooner had I walked in than I felt befuddled. What a bewildering array of the printed words. I spied a table with a sign saying, Books by William Faulkner. That name rang a bell. I had heard that name somewhere before. I asked the sales lady if he was a reputable author. He is one of our most famous, she said. Right underneath my hand was a book entitled Requiem for a Nun. What a beautiful title for a religious book, I thought. I had the sales lady wrap it up on the spot. Judge paused. So I presented Requiem for a Nun to Miss Lady on her birthday. He paused again. That book is not about nuns. Doesn't have a thing in the world to do with nuns. I thought of my friends at college. What would they think of my grandfather, a man who didn't know who Faulkner was? I was afraid that Judge and Miss Lady would decide that the intellectually sophisticated world of Harvard that I found so exciting was too radical and dangerous for a girl who had had such a sheltered upbringing. It seemed that Henrietta would take forever clearing the table for dessert. Finally, she brought in the cake, set it down before me, and handed me a cake knife. She stood beside Miss Lady's chair, and we didn't dare look at each other. Miss Lady tilted her head to one side, tasted her serving of cake, and laid her fork down on her plate. She arched her hand a little, the way she always did when she was tasting and considering. Darling, she said, this is the best jam cake I ever tasted. Then she became aware that Henrietta was standing at her elbow. As good as when Henrietta makes it. The cake was sagging in the middle and leaning a little, lopsided, but Judge and Miss Lady had not noticed. It's a mighty fine cake, honey, said Judge. There was a delighted smile on his face, and his blue eyes were sparkling. Although his granddaughter was a student at Harvard, she was really just like his mother, Miss Della. She could make the Tennessee jam cake. I knew that I would be returning to college for the spring semester.
Thank you. One of the beauties of the book, Dinner at Miss Lady's, is on the following page from the excerpt that Luann just read from is a menu, and the title of the menu is The Meal That Saved My College Education. And then the reader is given all of the recipes to the meal, that Luann just discussed. And that's one of the delights of the book, I think. Luann, when you were reading that excerpt of the book, you said that you had a lifelong desire to be a writer. How did writing Dinner at Miss Lady's affect your life when it was published by Algonquin and you began to receive the critical reviews? How did that affect your life, and how did that feel coming when it did in your life?
Well, it was wonderful. It's hard for me to say how good it really was for me. The critical response to the book was so good, and of course made me so happy, my first book. What surprised me is that different kinds of people liked the book. It's not only a woman's book. Many men have read it and liked it. My cleaning lady likes it. My mother's friends like it. My sophisticated poet friends like it. X.J. Kennedy called the book a classic. I know that it seems truly bragging to say something like that, but I'm so proud of his saying that, and I hope it's true. Fred Chappell, a wonderful Southern writer, who's a friend of mine, a poet as well as a fiction writer, is liked the book very much. I have been so happy about it. I have, as I said, as you said, as you know, I've always wanted to be a writer ever since I was a child. And I did some writing at Harvard that received some attention, and I was considered to be very promising. And then went for long years when I couldn't write. I would try and occasionally send something off, but always got back a rejection. And so I was very discouraged. And yet somehow I didn't give it up. I wouldn't give it up. And when Algonquin accepted the book, you can imagine how happy I was.
Oh, yes.
And it's given me, I know now that I am a writer, and I have a direction in my life. I have books I want to write, poems as well as the prose. And it makes such a difference to have something, to have work to live for and to look forward to every day.
That's wonderful. And I think it says something to the tenacity it takes to be a writer, that there's a lot of discouragement and rejection along the way, but if it's something that one loves and sees as one's vocation, that you can't give up heart. You have to continue to read and to write, and at some point in time let go of the publication aspect of the business until it happens. And sometimes there's some luck involved, there's some misfortune involved, and I'm so glad that you persevered through that period of time, so that now that you have a direction in your writing life, as you say, and that you're pursuing it. And I'm just so glad that you didn't throw in the towel like so many other writers have done over the years.
It was very difficult, but I think once I actually began the writing, I forget about all the difficulty, the rejections, the long years of unproductiveness and sterility. I forget about that and just am glad I'm writing.
Good. I'm delighted today to be joined by Luann Landon. We've been discussing dinner at Miss Lady's. Now we're going to shift gears a bit. And Ms. Landon is also a published poet, has won some prizes. And I've asked her to be so kind as to, she's going to read a couple of the poems. And the first two we're going to hear we're going to treat this a little differently, because the third poem she's going to read is going to be a segue into what she's working on right now. So if you would, Luann, if you would introduce the first poem to us and tell us a little bit about it, where it was published, and then be so kind as to read it for us.
Yes. I have published quite a lot in the Cumberland Poetry Review, a very fine review published in Nashville, Tennessee. They had a contest every year, the Robert Penn Warren competition. And in 1998, Dana Gioia gave me third prize for a sonnet. It was published in the fall issue of 1998 of the Cumberland Poetry Review. Every Hungry Sparrow. There was a woman lovely and unkind, who thought the very wind her own breath sound. The sun, the rain, all gardens met her mind. She trailed her given roses on the ground. A foraging bird amused her lazy eye. She was the nymph in every laboring wood. When morning woke her with a nameless cry, she smiled and all her callousness seemed good. Can such sure-bodied ego cease to be? Her mirror answers yes, no more deferred, or only for a while her amity with earth. Now no heart tenderer than hers. She weeps and wants a providence in her end, and every hungry sparrow to be her friend.
Thank you, that's beautiful. Now let's, if you do the same, please, for the second poem that we had talked about.
Yes. Mark Jarman gave this poem second prize in the Warren competition, and it was published in the fall 2002 issue of Cumberland Poetry Review. Form. Visible only in sunlight, not in shadow. In the corner of a window, hung between branches, itself in itself, indifferent to the succulent meadow and all the baggage of summer, containing, not reaching, and light, so light, like silk stretched taut, intact, giving in the wind. And within a spare symmetry of design, every quirky jut and angle, projected over empty space, in a tenuous, confident thrust of considered daring, ancient dwelling always open and unfriendly, and quiet, quiet, forever not answering any human word. No personality in itself, just a bold, airy cleft in a world that when the spider leaves, is left.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Now, we're going to shift gears here a little bit, and the next poem you're going to read for us has something to do, I believe, with the work in progress that you have. And if you could tell us a little bit about the third poem you're going to read for us, and then we'll talk about the work in progress you have.
My husband and I have lived several years in France, not all at the same time, not all consecutively, but off and on. At least 5 or 6 years, and we both studied French in high school and college, and then when we lived in France, we spoke it. You know, if you go to the butcher in France, you in Paris, you almost have to speak French in order to get your chicken.
Sure.
And the next book, the book I'm working on now, my next book, is a memoir, is a book of, based upon memories of living in France, especially Paris, mainly Paris. We met many interesting, wonderful people, both Americans abroad and French people. And the poem I'm going to read now is about a lady whom my husband and I boarded with. We lived in her apartment. We had a small apartment in her larger apartment, and she became a friend. She was an older lady when we knew her, and then she grew very, very old and now is dead. I became so fond of her, admired her so much, and in this poem I tried to express some of my love of this person and of her French world, of her French culture, to use a big word.
Mm-hmm.
The name of the poem, La Femme au Soleil, The Woman in Sunlight. She lives on a quiet street, a modest street in an elegant neighborhood. Morning sun sets forth the long, glistening double windows, red geraniums, shutters, balconies, forthright facade, light on an unlined face. Red carpet in the lobby, an antique lift that rises haltingly to the fourth floor. Distant noises hushed, the doorbell sounding like a soft voice that knows it will be heard. Madame opens the door and kisses me on both cheeks, takes my hand, leads me gently down the hall. We pass the kitchen, table of firm oak, little stove, porcelain sink just fit in their space. On the table, a loaf of bread and a pottery jar of crisp parsley. We stand a moment in the door of the salon, then enter to light, music, morning air, blue walls and windows curtained with watered silk. She has arranged with a knowing hand antiques, porcelain, pictures from her old apartment, much larger, in the Faubourg Saint-Germain. I think of the apt, poised, luminous objects in a painting by Chardin. The frame of her life is smaller, but still just filled, not crowded, with her things. Clustered on a damask panel, several small portraits, miniatures, ancestors in their period dress, some solemn and seaworthy in plain black cloth, others earlier, brighter and more bendable, in blue and yellow satin, fluent laces. Their hands sustain a flower or a fan. The faces do not change much. Genial faces, flushed with health and good conscience. Honnête gens, who live rightly and well. We take armchairs in a warm corner. I ask about her daughter, her son-in-law, ambassador now to Sweden. Her great-grandchildren visit every Thursday. Her summer house in Brittany. Mushrooms are growing through the kitchen floor. Next year, she must manage a new roof. What she is, a person with nothing to hide. A father lost in the First World War, a husband lost in the Second. She raised her daughter with little money, kept the family furniture and houses, drove every weekday in her little slow deux-chevaux to the factory outside Paris. Social work was her profession. She grocery shopped each evening, cooked dinner every night, saved, upholstered, mended, went to Mass on Sunday, made the right clothes for her daughter. In 44, hid Jewish friends in her attic, kept her head when the Gestapo knocked. She did it all, simply, quietly, watching, waiting, laughing when she could. Now her small hands practiced and steady, hand me a cup of coffee. Behind her, I see a painting I've never noticed, a woman in white, a long white dress, stands in a doorway, sunlight about her. She's on a threshold, entering, not backing out. My father was a painter, one of the Impressionists. Nowadays, nobody's heard of him, but he was friends with Sisley and Renoir. The big German officer came in, stood on the threshold. He saw the young woman, strong and very soft, hoping in her clear blue room. Something shifted in his brain, eased, lightened the huge satanic despair. He looked
Thank you.
Our guest today is Luann Landon. We've discussed Dinner at Miss Lady's, which is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, and we've listened to three of Ms. Landon's poems. Now, to wrap up the interview, I've asked Ms. Landon if she would to tell us a bit about her work in progress, which, as she mentioned prior to reading the last poem, is it similar in structure, would you say, Luann, to Dinner at Miss Lady's, or is the structure of this one going to be a bit different?
Well, it will be more or less chronological, as Dinner at Miss Lady's was. I think that it will cover a longer period of time, and I've written the first and most of the middle of the book, and now I'm working on the last part of the book. If it's to be read chronologically, doesn't necessarily mean it was written chronologically.
Right.
I'm enjoying writing it because I'm just enjoying thinking about Paris and the France. We've lived other places in France and traveled a little bit. We've lived in Strasbourg and Aix-en-Provence briefly, but mostly in Paris. And I find that I am remembering things. Oh, Kathy at Algonquin, my good editor, says, I think you can say a little more here, and that starts me thinking, and I remember so much more than I had originally written down. And that's a very fulfilling experience, very, very pleasing. I think the book will probably need quite a lot of rewriting, and I usually rewrite quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And revise quite a lot. But I'm hoping that I can just convey what I feel and think about French culture and about Paris and about the people I know there. There are so many books about France, of course, written by scholars and people who are specialists in one small, narrow field. I am just staying close to my experience, using my imagination as well as my memory. And I'm not a scholar, I'm not a literary critic, so that I'm not writing some of the very sophisticated and wonderful things that have been and are being written about French culture. I'm simply writing about a young woman who lived in France and discovered many mysterious and wonderful things, some very happy, very joyful, very full of pleasure and delight, others very sad, very, very, in the Jamesian sense, Paris is, and France are still the old world and still quite different from American life.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I think that the country has been very Americanized probably in the last 10 years. I haven't been back to Paris for 10 years. But I'm writing about just my personal feelings.
Good. Well, I look forward to it. Now, will there be recipes?
Yes, there will. There will be recipes. There will be recipes given me by French friends, my French women friends who, French women tend to be such wonderful cooks, and the recipes they've given me, I haven't seen in any cookbook. They're just wonderful.
Oh, good. Well, we've got something to look forward to there as well.
Yes.
Well, I'm really looking forward to obviously to the next book, and I'd like to urge all of the listeners to read Dinner at Miss Lady's. It gives you a look back at a time that in history which is very interesting and seems to have passed us by a bit. And I enjoyed the book very, very much, and I'm looking forward to the next book when it comes out. And so, Luann, if we could do this, how about if we make a tentative date to have you back on the show when the next book comes out, and we can discuss that book at that point in time. And I'd like to thank you very much for your gracious time today and all the support that you've given to the show. I know you're a listener as well as now a guest, and I appreciate that very, very much.
Yes, I am, and thank you so much, Casey. I've so enjoyed it.
Good. Well, join us next week for another guest on the Casey Kohar Show, and we'll talk to you then.